Hi there. My name is Flash Rosenberg, and I'm artist in residence here for Live from the New York Public Library. Thank you. And what you just saw is really a portrait of all of us when we're listening to an event. Like, instead of drawing the events as they happen and try to, like, doing caricatures or court portraits of the celebrities, I'm trying to make a picture of what it's like when the ideas are mingling in your brain and you don't remember who said what, but it all sits there as a sensation. And I have to tell you how grateful I was to hear people laughing at the economy. That was really a wonderful sound to hear backstage. And now what I'm going to be doing tonight, I need some help, because besides drawing the thing, and you'll be able to see it live as it's happening, although I won't quite be doing it that manically quickly, because obviously I have to wait till I hear what they say before I can draw it. And my wonderful video editor, Sarah Lohman, who's in the back, helps me get it more up to speed. But I figured while I was drawing, I would also let my dress draw itself. And so I have Jade and Elodie are here trying to get the colors to go down. Is it working? Is it? Oh, boy. And so all these pens have to do this. This gives me much more time to talk about what else is on deck for you tonight. We have to admit that we love the library, that it's trying to bring new energy into performance, from Sharpies and dresses to all the different events that are happening. And so we would like for you to join. It's only $40, and for that you get two free tickets to any program you want in May and June. And since tickets are $25 each, you've already, you know, it's a bargain. You don't even need to see a video on the economy to know that's a pretty good deal. And, oh yes, a basket is being passed around. Now you could put money in it to help support the video works, but what they really would like you to do is give answers. Yes? You want your answers in there, and then Andre and Henry will be looking for their questions. Right? Is that what you're going to do?
Either or.
Oh, either or. Questions or answers. Either or. Well, then write something, and if it's a question or an answer, it might be subverted into the other thing when they perform. Okay, there also will be a book signing after the event. You can sign books you brought yourself, books you plan to write, or you even more productively buy the books of the speakers tonight. That's the logical thing, but this isn't a logical night. It's Dada. Let's see. One more. It sort of reminds me of the government. Lots of things happen to you, and you can't quite see what it is, but you think you've voted for it. Okay. Now, I would like to introduce Mark Twain. Oh, let me see. Before I do that, you can see this. I think all artwork now should come with a gigantic URL in the middle of it. This is what I have tried to launch here by having this drawing of Adam Gopnik and Paul Holdengraver be illustrated, and this lets you know where you can look for programs at the library. Okay, and now I'd like to introduce Mark Twain, who is now witty about being dead, so he can most eloquently explain what's going to be happening here at Live tonight. Thank you.
Good evening. My name, as you know, is Mark Twain, and I am dead. If I had had more time, I would have made it shorter. It is a statement, and yet it is my statement, and I am regretful to say that over and over again, people attribute it to Blaise Pascal. But this is really ridiculous, because it is mine. However... Here we are, with Dada. I promise you, I was Dada first. Just read my conversations with Satan, read The Privilege of the Grave, or The Happy Memories of the Dental Chair. It's all included in the book I am signing perhaps tonight, Who is Mark Twain? By Mark Twain himself, which is most surprising. And it's never been before published. But really, I don't want to say that I've been Dada before anybody else, because I really don't want to get into a fight with Andrei Codrescu, who has written a book, The Post-Human. What is that? I really wonder. I had enough trouble when I was alive with the humans. But anyway, I thought I would be done with them, and now there's this book. It's a good book, and you should buy it, because it will teach you nothing except how to live. His book is entitled The Post-Human Dada Guide, Tsara and Lenin Play Chess. I really wonder if they really ever did play chess, those two. Come on, anyway. It's just been published by a very famous university where I lectured when I was around as a bad boy talking my head off to pay off my debts, Princeton University. After I died, the philosopher Bertrand Russell famously said that Princeton was as good an imitation of Oxford as monkeys could have made. Well, perhaps that's funny. I'm not sure. Anyway, Andrei Codrescu is an NPR commentator and the author of many books of poetry and essays, including The Disappearance of the Outside. That's odd, really, I think. Last I checked, it was right there. Then there's Henry Alford, who has written a book about how to live. I personally thought that that's something you just did, but no. He has written a book entitled How to Live, A Search for Wisdom from Old People While They Are Still on the Earth. He quotes me, Mark Twain. Mark Twain, he says, I said. Mark Twain, he says, I said, wisdom is a reward you get for a lifetime of listening when you would rather have talked. Well, thanks very much, Henry. Henry, of course, is the writer, one of the writers for The New Yorker and for Vanity Fair. He's funny. He has won a Thurber Prize because I think he's funny. For Big Kiss, he's also of a humor collection, Municipal Bondage. Henry can be reached at, I don't understand these letters, but www.henryalford.com. His book will also be on sale and signed, so please get Dada and get How to Live and you will be all set. Then there's my book. It is a new book by a dead author, Mark Twain, entitled Who is Mark Twain? By Mark Twain himself. Never before published, as I said, the cover says. I am pleased and I thank my publisher for publishing me at this late date, at this late stage in my life, or non-life. In truth, I always liked the idea of publishing a preposterous work or a preposterous book. But this one is special and close to my heart. I might be signing it after after this event where we might go gaga with Dada. Oh, and I nearly forgot tonight, we also have Max Radadada, whose slideshows include the largest dust bunnings in the world, over 2.5 pounds. Radadada will be performing unexceptional tricks, he's already done a few, around the Isle of Manhattan. For instance, tomorrow at 11 a.m., he will be mending and repairing with money on Wall Street, because everything is better with money. There's a method to our madness tonight. Alford and Codrescu are going to cross-question each text using the oracular method of bibliomancy, which is the use of books in divination. Some Christian and Jewish groups forbid divination. Some permit it as a whisper. So they might just whisper. Bibliomancy is sometimes referred to as stichomancy, the divination, as you will have guessed, from lines. Alford and Codrescu and I, Twain, to some extent, will use the oracular method to show just how oracular we are. We will open our books at random. All answers are there, and we will question and answer each other using our words. I won't do too much of that myself, but I just might. Radadada will read your questions at the end, though we would prefer, to some extent, that you submit answers, and Andre and Henry will divine them. What the question was will be up to them. Just like the bumper sticker I saw the first time I came to America, which stated, I will never forget this, that God is the answer. I still wonder, and from the grave, what the question was. After that, you will go and buy the book, and after that, you will go and get drunk with us. Now, here, to get us started, welcome Andrei Codrescu and Henry Alford.
Mark Twain, you're
Thanks,
call.
Mark. I'm slightly terrified by the images behind us. Whenever I go into a shopping mall, I'm amazed that people will pay money to go to those caricaturists, and it's sort of, you know, will you take my worst feature and exaggerate it grotesquely?
What is that worst feature of yours?
Well, we will soon find out.
What's with those shoes?
These are actually something I got in Morocco. They're pantoufles. And I realized...
Can you say that just one more time?
One more time. Yes, I can butcher French as well as English. It occurs to me that most of my favorite words in French begin with the letter P. Like there's that la pellicule, which I think means film.
Right.
If someone says, how was your evening? You can say pellicule.
You can, if you want to.
Pamplemousse, of course, is a fabulous... P starting French word, and then les pantoufles.
And pamplemousse means what?
Is grapefruit.
Grapefruit, yeah.
Les pantoufles is the slippers. I don't know if it's correct French, but I like to say je suis pantouflé.
It isn't correct.
It isn't correct. No. Put it away. I'll throw it away.
And is there a story to these pantoufles? Maybe not.
I think this very evening might be their big moment.
You should know that you can see what is happening behind you on that screen in front of you.
So we're living our worst features.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, exactly.
Great.
Well, I'm going to use my cheat sheet on this because I have no shoe expertise.
But do you have a shoe fetish?
No.
But
I'm 12...
It's a Chelsea boot.
No, it's just a $100, basic airport shoe that you can move quickly out and in and back up. And my cheat sheet says that it's fitting that George W. Bush's reign ended with shoes thrown at him in Iraq after he made everybody in the world take off their shoes at U.S. airport. Shoes are the 20th century's most potent metaphor. There was a shoe bomber. Remember him?
Yes, if I intimately.
There were riots in Pakistan, riots because of Islamic script written on the bottom of Nike sneakers. In Egypt and even in New York, guests must take off their shoes at the door. I mean, I haven't been in a whole lot of houses in New York where you have to do that, but you do in some places. Worshippers, of course, must leave their shoes before entering a mosque. And, of course, you know that the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C., and the Yad Vashem in Israel, there are mounds of shoes that belong to Jews murdered by Nazis. So to walk in shoes is sort of an essential act of civilized humans. But, you know, we walk barefoot in my place because I live in the country. I live on the Arkansas-Missouri border, where we don't know a French word from any word, actually.
Well, be careful.
We speak the way we do.
So I'm quite amazed. I bring up the subject of shoes, and you have something to say about it. You have something to say about everything.
Well, they're fundamental. You know, I mean, what is between your shoes and your hat?
Let me
maybe
think.
Your eyeglasses, you know. I mean, I did have those, but
Maybe a few other things.
A few other things, like a heart that beats faintly. Maybe a penis that stands correctly.
Sometimes. With some hope.
With some definitely hope. This is what we have in America as hope. We have God, money, and penis.
Right. You know the Kafka line, I've always loved this, hope, but not for us.
No. Indeed. So the oracular part of this business, I think, is that we are going to ask questions of our books, but, you know, I did write a little introduction that, you know, Paul kindly FedExed me Mark Twain's new book from New York to Baton Rouge, Louisiana, so that I could get it overnight, and I did.
I FedExed quite a few things.
Mark Twain himself didn't use FedEx. He didn't even care if his book was published in his lifetime, as you pointed out, because according to him, a dead man, quote, has one privilege which is not exercised by any living person, free speech. It sounds right, but the rights of dead men to free speech are still being debated. You know, to this day, actually, the FCC won't allow Allen Ginsberg's great poem, Howl, to be broadcast publicly because of the word fuck.
Careful, this is a library. You know,
but maybe because Allen's only been dead a few years now, you know. Maybe you have to be dead, like, for at least 10 years before you get full freedom of speech. Yeah. I'm not sure. What is it? 10, 12 years?
That sounds right.
So the book Twain waited 100 years to be published got to me in one night over a distance. It might have taken him, about 20 days to get to in 1905. That's in the case he wanted to deliver it to me personally, which he might have, if he'd known that I had to urgently be present here at the New York Public Library in order to witness the use of his book as an oracle about the future. The future, back when Twain wrote these pieces, was not quite so urgent. Though he would have loved FedEx, I'm sure of it. In fact, I think he invented it. The same year that Twain wrote some of these pieces, 1905 in February, Vladimir Ilyich Lenin, the daddy of communism, wrote, quote, "The uprising has begun. Rivers of blood are flowing. The civil war for freedom is blazing up." The first revolution failed. Rivers of blood did flow, but Lenin had spoken too soon. I Googled that one. It took me about 10 seconds, actually. Mark Twain would have definitely loved Google. It would have increased his productivity, you know. He wouldn't have had to go to the library
so
often. But
you're writing a book, you say, you claim, that sort of escapes the very notion of Googling. You want to deliver something to us that is un-Googleable.
Yes. And it was until it was published.
Right.
4 years later, in February 1909, F.T. Marinetti's Futurist Manifesto was published in Le Figaro, and it proclaimed, this is another quote, "We want to demolish museums and libraries, fight morality, feminism, and all opportunist and utilitarian cowardice. Museums, cemeteries, truly identical in their sinister juxtaposition of bodies that do not know each other. Public dormitories where you sleep side by side forever with beings you hate. Let the arsonists with charred fingers come. Here they are. Heap up the fire to the shelves of the libraries. Divert the canals to flood the cellars of the museums. Let the glorious canvases swim ashore. Take the picks and hammers. Undermine the foundation of venerable towns. The oldest among us are not yet 30 years old. We have therefore at least 10 years to accomplish our task. When we are 40, let younger and stronger men than us throw us in the waste paper basket like useless manuscripts." F.T. Marinetti and the Italian futurists had no patience at all. They wanted something even faster than FedEx and Google. They wanted fire.
This is very uplifting.
It is.
Yeah, you feel that
too. It's upbeat, yeah.
The fire did come when fascism embraced futurist ideas and nearly burned Europe down, so... And then came Tristan Tzara, daddy of Dada, who 7 years later in 1916 proclaimed Dada is against the future. And from where he stood in the middle of a world war, the future looked pretty bleak. The Dadaists cared nothing for posterity and didn't want to own the future. The speed of thought seemed quite sufficient, thank you. So tonight, you know, we have three oracular books standing by to answer your question, people of the future. I mean, I'm sure some of you are people of the future. Some of you are post-mortem, actually. Just hanging out, you know. The dead do like to hang out and pretend they're alive. I've seen that in myself. You know.
I have no future.
Well, people of the future is... To be, I ask, people of the future is to be mindful of what Ted Bergen said this in this wonderful poem called People of the Future. Said, people of the future, while you are reading these poems, remember you didn't write them, I did.
And you know the line of Paul Valéry that I so much like is that he said, the future isn't what it used to be.
Exactly. Which in this case means, people of the future, while you are hearing these answers to your questions, remember their authors didn't answer, their books did.
Right.
So whatever the authors may have thought about time, we're making them speak to you about the future.
What does your
Which is a reason to buy them.
What does your book, Henry, How to Live, tell us about the future? What did you try to do in...
It's a very rosy future. It's much more... it's flowery and delightful, whereas Andre's might be slightly darker, I would say. Google is an interesting question because I think Google has been a total elder killer in terms of elder wisdom. The fact that people can now Google information is really helping to erode old folks' status in society as the keepers of institutional wisdom.
Google has done that.
Google has indeed.
I am Google. Well, Google is the empire, you know. The empire strikes back. It is the empire. I mean, we put all our memories in it. You know, Aristotle had this down, actually, when he wrote about Thoth, the god of Egyptian god who invented the alphabet. And I have him quoted here in my cheat sheet, which is written in my book. The Aristotle... quoting chastising Thoth, the discoverer of the alphabet, says, this discovery of yours will create forgetfulness in the learner's souls because they will not use their memories. They will trust to the external written characters and not remember of themselves. The specific which you have discovered is an aid not to memory but to reminiscence. And you give your disciples not truth but only the semblance of truth. They will not be hearers of many things and will have learned nothing. They will appear to be omniscient and will generally know nothing. They will be tiresome company, having the show of wisdom without the reality. I mean, it's a few years ago.
In my time, we experienced things fully. We roughed it.
Well, we've finessed the Google.
And Google takes us away... from the wisdom of old people, from their stories, is that what you're in part saying? From their ability to count what has happened to them?
Sure. Because what if you're a little kid, you're not going to go ask your grandparents about such and such a thing if you can bang it out on Google. Yeah, that much faster. So remember that. Remember Granny. The next time you Google.
Yeah, no. I actually plan on never Googling again.
Do you have a granny, Pop?
No, but I mean, I feel that I killed her by Googling.
Right.
You have. We've killed our ancestors by Googling them.
Well, Andre's book makes an interesting distinction between when you're talking about... avatars have this idea that now, that in the future, we'll have these icons which can sort of make us immortals. If you have an icon online, and in talking about this, he makes a distinction between your avatar and what he calls your meat body, which is a phrase because I have a lot of meat going on.
So it's a difference between. Your face and MySpace?
Definitely. I mean, MeetSpace is where it's at, you know.
Meet.
It is. You can be bi-dimensional and even, you know, tri-dimensional or virtual. As virtual as you can get, you will never quite get to MeetSpace in this particular lifetime if you put your trust in virtual reality.
Is that the meaning of the word post-human?
Yes, and it is a meaning actually that takes it out of the series of post-modern, post-feminist, post-colonial, and all those post-it notes.
Post-raising brand, yeah.
Because those are quite specific. Post-modern is about a style.
Right.
Post-feminism is about the reaction to the feminism of the 60s. Post-colonial is about what people do when they've escaped the empires. Post-human is something more serious because it's about what happens when you give up the idea of what you think is human. Not that human was ever that great. I mean,
yeah.
What's so great about being human, you know? How great was it being a Jewish human in 1942? I mean, yeah. How great was it being a human when you were a peasant in Romania in the 19th century? You know, it was not so great. So, you know, the idea of removing that particular word from all its contexts, you know, especially the humanities, which is something we insist on making a specialty. It's a good idea, you know. All of that is a good idea. But, you know, there's this thing, this post-human thing, you know, which is this thing, you know. I have this, like, braces on my head. It's like these wires, you know, and they were wired completely. You know, I have it in my pocket. I have it on my head, you know. I live, you know, I walk around in a city that is completely ordered by mechanisms and electronics. And so,
and so Dadaism is an antidote to this excessive mediation.
Yes.
The fact that we no longer look at each other, touch each other. As I often say, you can't, I mean, you can, but please don't misunderstand me, but you can't really tickle yourself. I mean, you can, of course. But
it's the kind of word that makes you miss George Bush if George Bush was an intelligent human being.
But so,
because he never finished a sentence.
So. Yeah, right. But so how is Dadaism, how does that work for us post-humans, that by bursting out into little Dadaist acts, that's bringing us back to our humanity?
Read a passage randomly. Read a passage that would somehow help us.
Well, this is all cheat sheet because it's, you know, the book is the book and it does what it does. But I wrote another book that I stuck inside. Dada.
So you were really cheating.
I was definitely cheating. But it's only taped on one side, so I can lift it and read what's underneath. Dada, the attempt to make memorable things that cannot be memorized. A technology of aesthetic warfare. Indolent young punks keeping awake older revolutionaries. Dada is eccentric because there is no center. Dada is not eccentric because the center is where Dada is. Mark Twain is the king of Dada. And that's because he's singular. And Dada was plural, actually. It was a movement. America is de facto Dada. Mark Twain is one of America's daddies. He lives in New Orleans when he lives. So when you decide to live again, do come. Well, it's just a passage.
I'm interested in what were in some of the personal lives of the Dadaists, because it strikes me that that you invite Dada to the party, but you don't marry Dada, right? That it's a very exciting, vivid, woo approach to life, but wow, what kind of a personal life does one have when one is lining urinals with fur or bursting into poème simultanées or any of these rather exciting forms of communication?
Well, you know, that's a matter of choice and how long do you plan to keep your body.
And my meat body.
Yes, and yes. How far are you going to go to expand it? You know, now a true Dadaist would probably consume his or her flesh body by the age of 30. In full blossoming joy of consumption of self.
And that, at which point? What? At which point?
However, some people ration their bodies. You know, and they keep them into their 60s and 80s, as some people do in your book, and they do well.
Right.
Because they keep this moment of joy of, you know, and wisdom going to preserve them. And it works.
Right.
It works. But, I mean, if you're a dedicated Dadaist, which is a kind of contradiction in terms, you would just spend it quickly. And you would not make it past your 29th birthday. I mean, there's no reason to.
Right.
So perfection and duration don't go together.
No, they don't, actually. Perfection is brief. Duration is long. I mean, it lasts.
I have to say, my weirdest experience with reading your book was that you refer repeatedly to a poetess, I believe, named Minna Loy. And, of course, every time I saw Minna Loy, I kept going, why is Myrna Loy in a book about Dada? And it reminded me of there's a party game where you take a famous person's name and you remove one letter from it and then explain who that person is. And a friend did Myrna Loy, and he said, she's the star of I Gave Them the Best Years of Their Lives.
Well, you know, that's quite funny, but, you know, there is something, however, truly essential about Minna Loy, the poet, who was British-born Jewish, who was the young lover of Marinetti, who wrote the Futurist Manifesto, and she wrote a kind of poetry that really would have saved American literature from T.S. Eliot. And actually would have saved American poetry from this eternal feud between Pound and Eliot. Because what she did was write an extremely contemporary sounding verse that was right on and very direct about her relationships, her life. Uh-huh. And to read Minna Loy, actually, not Myrna Loy, which my student constantly confuses her with because, you know, she's the better known one of those, but Minna Loy was that path. She didn't take it. She came to New York and she had, you know, her moments, you know, including a famous threesome with Marcel Duchamp and his wife, which they all wrote about, and became a sort of a bag lady who collected things in New York and, you know, then went to live with her daughter and, you know, never looked after her literary career. And had she done that, you know, she would have probably solved our Eliot Pound problem.
Right.
But she didn't. And, you know, consequently, you know, we have to write about her and sort of try to bring her back. But that's impossible. I mean, you know, she didn't do her thing at the time, which is another, you know, Dada problem, is you don't go with the zeitgeist, you're fucked.
Right. And that was an interesting part of the book, too, where you talked about how, for some of the visual artists, that Dadaism, that New York was central to their project, simply because there's more stuff to be found on the street.
And more congestion.
Well, there's more stuff, because, I mean, when Max Ernst married Peggy Guggenheim, he had lots of time and money, so he could run around with André Breton and find stuff in the junk stores. So they could run around.
Who would leave that house in Venice?
Make art, you know. So, well, yeah, I mean, he was not. I mean, he was a little, maybe, you know, maybe she loved her dogs more. I don't know. Does anyone know?
You had very unkind things to say at the beginning about libraries, quoting Marinetti. Yet libraries, we are in one of them at this moment, the New York Public Library that has 52 million items and 7 floors of books and goes right under Bryant Park. It's a very prestigious library, a very heavy library. I've actually always wondered how much it weighed. And actually nobody has to this day been able to tell me. Do you know how much it weighs by any chance?
I think it weighs as much as your soul.
Well, that is right. Ooh. I mean, this is oracular. We were saying oracular.
It certainly weighs more now that we've said penis and fuck inside.
It is, yeah. But what I would like to know is
it decreases the weight.
But I mean, yeah. But for both of you, libraries have played an incredibly important role. You, Henry, went, as your book relates in How to Live, a lot to libraries.
Yes, and I quote your favorite library quote about the death of an old person is like the burning of a library.
That is true. It's not my quote, Mark Twain's quote. It's a quote.
It is your African quote. I've heard you say it.
It is my African. It's an African...
It is the Holden Graber who lives in Africa.
No, I do suffer from a disease called quotomania. You are right about that. But, and he does say that a wise old man who dies is like a library on fire. Something like that. But I digressed.
And, yes. Well.
And it is a sunshine of narrative.
Please do. I was waiting the library.
No, but the library. You go in search of wisdom in the library.
You go. Wouldn't you? I mean, where else would you go?
Exactly. And what do you find when you're looking for wisdom in the library? You're looking for quotations from great writers. Because your book is a mixture, I might say, a potpourri, use a French word.
Yes.
It is a potpourri of people's experience and great wisdom throughout the ages.
Yes, and like potpourri, it's something that people are putting on top of their toilet.
They are. Yeah.
I would
want to know, you know, among the wisdom, well, maybe differently put, what wisdom did you in fact find at the library?
I am someone who loves aphorisms. I have to say that they boil a lot down into a few words.
That is enough.
I have one of them for you.
Do you? Let's hear.
Yeah.
In your chit-chat.
I hate ambiguity. It takes two of them to get me off.
That's nice.
Well, you.
Yeah.
No, I mean you have discovered amazing wisdom in libraries. For instance, you quote this wonderful line of the I Ching. I love that line where it says, "Deliver yourself from your great toe, then the companion comes, and him you can trust."
Right, as an example of just crazy wisdom, like what?
Yeah,
go figure. Another.
So you don't have a clue what that means.
Is that a Wilhelm Reich translation?
Very possibly. It's so out there. The other one that was very odd to me was, there's a Jean Cocteau one about whatever the public criticizes in you, amplify. It is you. Which, on the face of it, you think, that's very counterintuitive and interesting. But then you think, wait, I'm going to, again, like the, you know, exaggerating your worst, quote, facial feature, that you're going to take your worst quality and amplify it?
I do that all the time. When you just quoted that, I immediately thought to myself, can I be witty? And can I come up with another Cocteau line?
Yeah.
And
right.
You know, some of the public might have had it of my quotations, but yet I cannot keep myself from quoting this line from Cocteau about Victor Hugo. Do you know it?
I don't. No.
Cocteau said that Victor Hugo was a madman who mistook himself for Victor Hugo.
Oh.
You don't know that line.
That's good. I'll hit you back with a quote.
Okay.
What your problem is, son.
No, quote it. You have to say quotation.
Get off of my lawn.
Okay.
No, what your problem is, son, is you have the Fran Lebowitz quotation problem, which is she said that the opposite of talking is not listening.
Right.
It's waiting.
Right.
I'm with you, Henry. That must be a European thing, man.
Waiting, planning, scheming.
Yeah.
I'm silent now. Yeah. I am just...
That's fine. You are Mark Twain.
I'm just going to be here waiting.
Will not. Yes.
No, come back. Come back to the raft, Huck, honey.
uh,
Which one was your favorite?
I hope Flash got that.
Which one was your favorite? I'm sure she has. Tell us some wisdom. So, I mean, because the I Ching stuff I read is... No, you learned... Why write this book about old people? I mean, why did you bother? I mean, why did both of you bother write your books?
Well, maybe mine was an elaborate excuse to spend some time with Sylvia Miles. Are you familiar with Sylvia Miles? Yeah.
Sylvia here?
No, she is not here.
And with Harold Bloom?
And Harold Bloom, yes, totally charming. But Sylvia, I've been to the apartment,
right,
is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
And Sylvia has a famous, again, speaking of quotes, people disappoint you, lovers disappoint you, but theatrical memorabilia stays with you as long as you keep it under clear plastic wrap. And so Sylvia, whose age is not to be mentioned ever, lives on Central Park South in about a 600 square foot apartment, and this is essentially the Sylvia Miles Museum of Memorabilia. And literally, I was walking around and I had to literally suck in my stomach at one point lest I knock over a teetering pile of playbills. Pictures all over the wall. We walk by one. She says, that's me and Shelley Winters. She's the fat one. And the reason why you would talk to someone like Sylvia Miles, Oscar-nominated actress, is that she, at one point in her career, she got a very, very nasty review from John Simon, who is the meanest critic in the world. Respond to this, Sylvia found out about a party that he was going to be at, and she went to the party, went up to the buffet table, got a plate, filled it with cottage cheese and a pork chop and some little ham rolls and an onion puff and some Melba toast, and then walked up to John Simon and whomp, dumped it on his head. Talk about Dada in a post-human world. I mean...
Well, I have written about that in some way. I wrote a piece which you may be familiar with, since I had Paul FedEx it to you. Whenever I'm about to publish a book, I feel an impatient desire to know what kind of a book it is. Of course, I can find this out only by waiting until the critics shall have printed their reviews. I do know beforehand that the verdict of the general public will be, because I have a sure and simple method of ascertaining that, which is this, if you care to know.
We do. Okay. Please, proceed.
I always... No, I just...
Andre, not so much.
No, it's just because... It's because of... I stopped
there. I caught ADD from my students.
No, I stopped there because of the mean things you said before to me, about Fran Lebowitz and myself. I always read the manuscript to a private group of friends composed of as follows. 1, man and woman with no sense of humor. Man and woman with medium sense of humor. Man and woman with prodigious sense of humor, an intensely practical person, a sentimental person, a person who must have a moral in and a purpose, a hypercritical person, natural floor picker and fault finder, an enthusiast, a person who enjoys anything and everything, almost, a person who watches the others and applauds or condemns with the majority, 6 bright young girls and boys, unclassified, a person who relishes slang and familiar flippancy, a person who detests them, a person of evenly balanced judicial mind, and last, but as you will see from what I say, a man who always goes to sleep. These, and I will just read the following paragraph to give you a sense of how I survived for all these years and ever since I've been dead, all the critics. These people accurately represent the general public. Their verdict is a sure forecast of the verdict of the general public. There's not a person among them whose opinion is not valuable to me. But the man who I most depend upon, the man whom I watch with the deepest solicitude, the man who does not, who does most deciding me, does most towards deciding me as to whether I shall publish the book or burn it, is a man who always goes to sleep. If he drops off within 15 minutes, I burn the book. If he keeps awake 3/4 of an hour, I publish. And I publish with the greatest confidence too. For the intent of my works is to entertain. And by making this man comfortable on a sofa and timing him, I can tell within a shade or two what degree of success I'm going to achieve. His verdict has burned several books for me, 5 to be accurate. So
probably quite charitable, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what kind of a book do you think, Andrei, you have written?
Well, you know, Gogol burned the second part of Dead Souls, the good part, because he was told that it was a very bad thing to have written the Dead Souls part because it was evil and sinful, and he burned the second, which Nabokov called the most charitable act in Russian literary history. So it's not a bad thing to burn those things, you know, whether because of an audience reaction or not, you know. But I can't afford to burn anything because I am so exuberant and they pay me so little for being optimistic. So I wrote Eaters of the World Unite. You have nothing to lose but your chains. If you were a restaurant, what restaurant would you be? Laura, the Half Moon Cafe in Baton Rouge. Beans and greens and ham hocks, everything. Starting up from beans again. Next day, gumbo. Stewed chicken dumplings after a late night drunk. Andre, a Greek diner in Midtown Manhattan. Hard to find, actually. Huge menu. Liver and onions, mashed potatoes, dumplings, matzo balls, soup, roast beef, moussaka, coffee, pie a la mode, everything incredibly fast, inefficient, in the middle of winter, 10 degrees outside. Less than a year after this conversation, the Half Moon Cafe in Baton Rouge closed, and there are no more Greek diners in Manhattan. America chained itself to frozen food and to pretentious, inexorably correct slaughter.
I have very little to say. You?
Well. Wow, that's heavy stuff. I don't know why I'm put in mind of this, but I recently wrote a story for the New York Times that was headlined "How I Learned to Love Eating Goat," and when the paper put it online, the poobahs at the Times felt that it was a vaguely pornographic headline.
So they removed the A?
No, they changed it to "How I Learned to Love Goat Meat."
Yes. If you add the word meat to anything, it sounds...
We're back to meat.
Back to meat. Yeah, but no, typically, yes, when you're making an effort at decorousness, I think you want to inject the word meat.
Oh, yeah.
into the situation.
The old people you met are hopeful?
Yeah, lots of crabby. There was some crabbiness. I won't lie to you.
I mean, for instance, let's focus for a moment because I like his crabbiness. I mean, he's so cantankerous and one feels he drinks Drano in the morning. Harold Bloom.
Harold Bloom has taught at Yale for 50 consecutive years. That's quite something.
It's like a consecutive sentence, is that?
Yeah.
He served.
He served, yes. And this is a gentleman who looks exactly like Zero Mostel. Who called
me... Do you
me,
love me?
Yeah. he called me my dear, I'm going to say, 23 times in the course of 2.5 hours. He had to. I mean, with this punim. And he... there was an interesting moment with Bloom where his telephone rang, and it was a student of his who was calling to contest a grade, and Bloom gets on the phone and ends the conversation saying, "No, no, 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 no." Bam! Slams down the phone, and then turns around and yells back to his wife, who's back in the kitchen, "Darling, if that gentleman calls again, tell him that your husband has died."
So, writing a book
what
about...
What number wife was this?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But writing a book about aging and old age is writing a book also about that last chapter.
Yeah, because in a weird way, yeah, if you're going to interview people over the age of 70 about wisdom, you're writing a book about aging too. It just, there's no way around it. The aches and pains are definitely there.
Kind of the organ symphony.
The organ symphony, yes, a meat parade.
Well, this, you gentlemen are being terribly coherent. How about we just went to the oracular method and asked our books a question? And, you know, the thing about books being asked questions, they're always right if they're good books, and ours are.
Okay.
You ask a question, and then you open the book, and then you read the answer. And if it doesn't quite satisfy you, then A, too bad. B, we may explain.
Excellent. I think, Henry, you should start.
Okay. And I pose the question myself.
I can pose one to you. You pose one to me.
Yeah, why don't you pose me a question, and
I'll be happy to.
And then I'll answer.
Okay.
No,
I'll be very happy to. The post-human data guide would like to ask Mr. Alford's book, How to Live. How to live, with an example, if possible.
How to live, okay. Opening it up at random. You could say that the theme of fierce ambivalence in human relations has been present in Edward Albee's work for a long time.
Yes.
See, ambivalence.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, Twain, can I ask you a question?
No, so you can, but before that, Albee was an easy interview.
No, he's tough.
He's really tough.
Yeah. He famously, there was a New Yorker profile about 7 years ago where I think it was Daryl Roth, it was one of the backers of one of his Broadway plays, refers to him as Edward Albee. And Albee says, "Actually, it's Albee." You know, it's like, yes, you have ponied up $4 million for my play on Broadway, but I'm just going to correct your pronunciation of my name.
Spell me right or die.
Yeah.
he says something that you quote in your book, which I quite like, that for him the most important thing is to pay attention.
Pay attention was part of his wisdom. And then his other... He agrees with William James that wisdom is knowing what to overlook.
Also known as Alzheimer's.
Yes, some people don't choose what they overlook. It falls upon them. Well, let's ask that of Andre. What shall we overlook?
What shall we overlook? Lenin does not underestimate the pawns, and he's not moved by their eventual disposition. Millions of them could be sacrificed in a tactical move as far as he is concerned, but it has to be the right move, the wise move, the dialectically useful move. Damn them all. If only the Swiss could be induced to forcefully eject him and his comrades on the grounds of inciting sedition, of trying to overthrow the fat cow of its government. That has to be the way. And so, without much effort, Lenin creates the rudimentary rhetorical bestiary of the next 75 years of the Soviet regime. Snakes, hyenas, dogs, and crows will be the basis of all attacks on the future enemies of the Soviet state. Capitalist hyenas, deviationist snakes, speculator crows, and rabid nationalist dogs are born in a single flash of Leninist thought.
I think... let me try myself. What needs to be overlooked?
It was being whispered around that Satan was in Vienna, incognito. And the thought came into my mind that it would be a great happiness to me if I could have the privilege of interviewing him. When you think of the devil, he appears, you know. It was past midnight. I was standing at the window of my workroom aloft, high aloft on the third floor of the hotel, and was looking down upon a stage setting which is always effective and impressive at that late hour. The great vacant stone-paved square of Mortzienplatz, and with its sleeping file of cab horses and drivers counterfeiting the stillness and solemnity of death. And beyond the square, a broad Milky Way of innumerable lamps bending around the far-reaching curve of the Donau Canal, which, with not a suggestion of life or motion visible anywhere under the glinting belt from end to end.
She was getting paid by the word, man.
Yeah, it's true.
It's just, sorry. I mean, the devil is really a great figure. But that's the European devil. I made him up, too, in the novel I wrote, and it's great. When he appears, the European devil is great. You know, he just shows up and he's civilized. It's not like the American devil, like, annihilating the entire universe. He shows up, he sits down, has a drink, has preferences in tobacco. You know?
Right.
You know, he's civilized. And, you know, Twain's devil is obviously civilized in that way. But then Twain, of course, you know, drove that point home because, you know, his readers probably didn't know what a Viennese civilized setting was like. You know, so.
There's another, there's a famous quote, a Twain quote about, that's sort of about what to overlook. He says, be careful when reading a book about health. You might die of a misprint.
Well, you know, my great teacher, Ted Berrigan, said great art is a great mistake. And he was completely right, because, for instance, one of the great poetry books of our time is a book called Meditations in an Emergency by Frank O'Hara. And I always thought that it was the quintessential expression of what we do now. It's meditations in an emergency, because we have to think fast in the middle of a fire. So I saw this in a factory building. I'm walking in there, and there's a little first aid thing, and it says medications in an emergency. And I thought, man, what a misreading. You know, that's genius, for Frank to read medications in an emergency as meditations in an emergency. That is a wonderful thing.
So what I mean,
Viva the typo.
So that, in a way, it brings us back to Bloom and to notions of misreading, of reading badly.
It doesn't bring us back to Bloom. It takes us away from Bloom.
You might be right.
Bloom is a rereader. He's a careful reader. You know, what this takes us to is this misreading, you know, the genius of misreading, the spontaneity of not paying attention to your consecrated culture.
So what does
your library.
What do your books tell us about the importance of intuition? Can you
deathly silence?
No, but can you
yeah.
You know, no, but open,
several
maybe.
Of my detachable organs come out when you say that.
But I think so, intuition is important.
Intuition is leaving your reserve or preserve.
Which one?
Both.
Intuition is everything. No, I mean, that's something that I write about is essentially...
Just let's try the random game. Open your book and see what you might...
Okay, I'm going to try to get something towards the end.
Yeah, I feel like there is something about intuition. Both of you are interested in your different way, the old people in what is happening right now, and Sarah is interested in some way also in the now.
We're still human, somewhat.
Okay. P.T. Barnum said, how are the receipts today at Madison Square Garden?
This is when he's dying.
These are famous last words, yes. And this speaks to intuition, which is that part of what I'm trying to say in my book is that I think that as we get older, we become more and more like ourselves. That either we're sloughing off societal constraints in a Dada way, or we're, you know, it took us a lifetime of fucking up to finally get it right, what have you. But that but that gradually you're becoming more and more the person who is quintessentially you. And at this point in the book, I'm trying to even trace it all the way to last words, that so many people's last words are so quintessential and so inimitable that they're almost like parody to me. Famously, Oscar Wilde died in a Parisian flop house and said, either the wallpaper goes or I do.
Yeah.
I mean, if you put that line in a movie, that it would be bad. It'd be bad dramaturgy. Or Henrik Ibsen spent his career scandalizing Victorian morality. On his deathbed, his nurse came up to him and said, you look better today, Herr Ibsen. And he said, on the contrary, and died. right. So it's like...
It is a very good lesson to practice your last word.
Practice, hone that last line.
I know. You never know when it might come.
Get it ready. Yeah.
It's the first assignment I give my students is to write their epitaph. And write an epitaph every morning. Just before you have your coffee, just after you have your coffee, write your epitaph. Because you don't know whether you're going to die that day or not. And then eventually you'll have a collection of epitaphs. Of course, that's becoming a little tenuous, just like writing and publishing and libraries are, because now people have video epitaphs. And
yeah.
You can go watch a grave that has a whole 10 minutes of deceased collected wisdom written by a ghostwriter, for hire. Or 2 hours, Andy Warhol style, 8-hour epitaph of the deceased saying nothing. And, nothing really ends that beautifully. I mean, it ended beautifully for some people,
right.
It ended terrifically.
See, this is pretty good. I like
it.
That's good. That's really good. I like that.
It ended terrifically for some people, so, here we go.
Before you read something, what's on your epitaph for the moment?
See you later. Eventually, the gates of hell were located in a town called Sunnydale, California, where Buffy the Vampire Slayer, working with academic textualists, works both to stem the tide of escapees from those dark regions and to keep the young from going in. Buffy does this forever on cable TV. Wherever there is cable, there I am. Grandpa Munster, Al Lewis to me in Havana, 1996. Buffy works for the Department of Postmodern Sanity, produced by the postmodern state of nausea and amusement. And so on. It goes on. But the epitaphs will never be definitive if you eat them. I've taught a seminar from 3 to 6 in the afternoon, and my students get very hungry.
Uh-huh.
And so I had them write poem on fruit, and they ate it. And they were happy. They ate their last words.
And then...
you have to, speak wisely, but also feed yourself and the masses, It's not a matter of dollars anymore. It's a matter of sharing the fruit of, your salary.
I think this is kind of the perfect moment, and I really don't know why, but I feel it's the perfect moment to have Max Radadada, if he is around. If he isn't around, where might he be? It would be good to have him perhaps read a question or two. He's coming slowly.
I thought he was going to be standing.
I thought so too.
Just collecting questions from the audience.
I thought he was collecting questions too. But while Max Radadada comes, I'd love to read something of my own, because I feel that I haven't shared enough of my posthumous or pre-posthumous work. Here it is a piece I wrote called Interviewing the Interviewer. interviewing the inter... It's hard. I find that my accent gets in the way.
It's okay. It's
worse if you're on LSD.
True, but I mean, yes. Imagine both of our accents here on stage. Interviewing the interviewer. Here is a Enter reporter. Mr. Mark Twain is dead. At least it is so reported. Is that so? Well, we have nothing against him. He never did any good. Publish an apparently friendly obituary of him and say at the end that we are pained to have to state that for many years he gained his livelihood by the nefarious practice of robbing graveyards. That will be sufficient. I have already dished him up in a column editorial about his imbecile article upon the Cuban patriot. I said, Mr. D, I beg pardon for mentioning it, but I am Mark Twain, to those remains, to whose remains you propose to give a unique and pleasant interest, and I am not dead. Oh, you are the person, are you? And you are not dead? Well, I am sorry, but I cannot help the matter. The obituary must be published. We are not responsible for your eccentricities. You could have been dead if you had chosen. Nobody hindered you. The obituary is fair game, for whatever is rumor to another paper is fact to the Sun. And now that you are here, handy, I will interview you. Please do give me the details of any aggravated or unnatural crimes you may have committed.
Is that a question?
No, it's just something I wrote, which I think is really quite quite special.
In the South, when we say special,
they mean something different.
It means something quite different.
It does, and they pronounce it spatial.
Yeah, he's so spatial.
That was very confusing to me. No. When I went, part of my book is my mom leaves her husband.
Your mom is there a lot.
There's a lot of mother.
A lot
yes.
of mother.
Can
lot
I lie
mother.
Down, doctor?
Yeah. No, please, please.
No, but we go and visit a lot of assisted living facilities in the South, and yeah, there's a lot of places that are spatial. So. Well, I think Max was,
Max
he was
is,
lurking.
Is coming down.
Hey, yes. Radadada, dude.
We have some
the
questions. The first.
And do we have a mic on Max Radadada?
We do.
We have turned it on.
The Radadada mic.
Max?
Explain the significance of your wardrobe choices.
Oh.
Go around.
Well, a weirdly pajamas figure. A couple of times in my book. One is that an elder gentleman tells me at one point, if you are an old man and you go into a bar wearing pajamas, people will buy you drinks. And then something similar reoccurs when I ask my stepfather, who has since passed away, but who was a consultant. I realize that he was a consultant and I'm a freelance writer, and so we have this commonality. And it occurs to me to ask him, so how do you bill? Is it hour to hour? And he said, no, pajama to pajama. So the meter is running.
Question? Repeat?
No, but do you have something to say about... I mean, because we don't look so dissimilar, I mean, at least in color.
Well, my answer to that is God created Jews to sing his praises. No, I mean, there are no bad Jews, only Jews who sing differently than other Jews.
I think I just wanted to look as... I wanted to wear one of the best suits I have. I wanted to look better than both of you. I wanted, my mother always said fine and dandy, and I wanted both of those to be illustrated here on stage. Also black. Black.
Black, it, yeah.
No, black is somehow, I felt
so,
I'm dead.
So TV is the
I'm
new
dead,
black.
I'm black. That reminds me of a story of my mother, again, because your mother features a lot, but my mother, when I was about 17, most of my friends wore black and dark black. And one day she asked me, you know, getting worried because I was reading only Schopenhauer and people like that, she looked at me and she said, Paulie, don't you have any friends who play tennis? So... I don't know. I just felt that I would wear this. And then I like these new shoes that I have a pattern on them. Did you see those?
Oh.
They're nice.
Those are good.
The answer is because all the wrong people have self-esteem. The question?
Yourself at the keyboard?
The question, what is California?
Question, not always a double affirmation is a negation. Is Dada an affirmation or a negation?
Oh, right, because there's one theory that holds that Dada is the sarcastic yeah, yeah.
That's no fucking theory.
That's just what. Yeah.
No. That's a good point. I mean, what, yeah, say something about the origin of Dada.
I'm going to ask my book. I say nothing. Tsara chuckles to himself, already convinced that Lenin's next move will be straight out of a book.
Yeah, no, that makes it clear for me.
Yeah.
Peter, I mean.
I'm not sure if this is question or answer, but there's several in this group. Raspberry Jello, baby buggy, rainbows, unicorns, and oranges.
Yeah. Yeah. No, you take the second. Take the second one.
The question is, what should I call my new Mylar balloon shop?
I think we can leave it there. That's perfectly nauseating.
I feel like you covered it.
Another? How would you characterize the state of contemporary fiction?
It is always being said that Lenin is guarded by Chinese. There were no Chinese here, is the quote. Already, one way to look at Lenin, as always guarded by the Chinese, is put to rest. W.T. Good was not in the mood to pass on more prejudice about supposed Chinese fanaticism or Lenin's, quote, oriental, unquote, roots. He really, really talked with the real guy. A difficult matter, quote, not because he's unapproachable. He goes about with as little external trappings or precautions as myself, but because his time is so precious. He, even more than the other commissaries, is always at work, unquote. There, the working man's idol works.
What he said.
Yeah, no. And what I would say to that is, whenever I'm about to publish a book, I feel an impatient desire to know what kind of book it is. And then I have a whole category of people who respond to the book differently. And the most important one to remember is Man Who Always Goes to Sleep.
I think this book's answer was about pure realism, that if you can actually commit realism, you're sort of in business. And your book does that, actually, in an amazing way. I mean, and that's the truth of the matter. I mean, I'm just not so interested in reading fiction, unless it is true.
Do you
not to say it's nonfiction. It's just true. That's all.
Right.
But not for you, right? Because you have certain habits.
In terms of reading material?
Yeah, I mean, I
read mostly fiction.
Yeah, and every year you read books again and again and again that
transport you.
Oh, you know, my Jane Austen takes such a beating in that.
I know, really does.
Because she is totally bitch slapped.
I know. Yeah. I know. I mean, that's how. I mean, he doesn't use those terms, but it's
It's a.
And he's so right.
She takes one. Wow. But up the
every year.
He thinks that Twain thought that Jane Austen was that the her point in writing books was to make. Really unlikable characters that you would hate until halfway through the book.
Which he never got to.
Which, yeah. Like, how would he know? Right, exactly.
That's good.
Yeah, so
and yeah. You take those books on vacation, summer readings? Or
I might do. Sure. Repetitive reading, yes, is good. Like repetitive wardrobe in movies.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm making your students type a whole novel they've just read.
Are you about to lie down?
No, I was going to. No.
Okay.
I'm going to listen to another
There's
question.
A few more. Answer. The paradox was confusing, but the dancing was nice.
Oh, well, that's lovely. Yeah. It, for some reason, it puts me in mind of the Tallulah Bankhead story where someone takes her to a Catholic mass and the priest comes down the aisle swinging the censer and gets up to Tallulah and she says, "Darling, your drag is divine, but your bag is on fire."
That's
Please
good.
Tell me it will be okay.
No, it won't. It really won't.
Yeah,
won't.
I don't think that person has come to the right event.
Oh, no. But I do like... No.
No, actually, I disagree with that completely. I think it is going to be totally okay. I think the spontaneity and sexy freedom of improvised revolt in Dada gave work to the grim work of Breton and his followers to find the secret keys to another world by employing the severely maintained marvelous. It's really not important to do that kind of grim work. It will be totally okay, and there is really no difference between life and death. You heard it here and elsewhere, but it's true.
Well, it brings to mind a quotation.
Oh, really?
You know, that gesture, I can't get
I'm
over
sorry.
It. No, I can't get over it, because when I arrived in this country after my trips through Europe, I was always amazed by that gesture. Whenever anybody wanted in this country to be ironic, they wanted to be sure that you would know it.
Well, you can do this.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, Nabokov says that the single quotes within double quotes is a sign of impending insanity.
I think he was absolutely right.
Wow. I have a new job, and then we'll hear your quotation.
No, I won't forget it. Believe me. I'll bring it in at any moment, even out of context.
Okay. But a new gesture. A friend was trying to be convinced to go onto the tour bus of the rock star John Bon Jovi, and was told by this other friend, "Oh, you got to come on the bus. There'll be all these suburban women. It might get." And that's the symbol for tops come off, right? For crazy time is, might get.
Now you're dissing New Orleans, man. You just watch it.
Well, this, for some reason, and for no good reason, this brought up two quotations now.
Oh, my God. We're the first one is
Woody Allen ending one of his stand-up comedy shows, saying, I would love to leave you with a positive comment, but would you accept two negatives? That's one of them. It's a good one. And the other one is, I think, more profound, and D.H. Lawrence, who said that reserving judgment is a matter of infinite hope.
Is that one he didn't know what to say?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's beautiful. I like that.
Yes, I always reserve judgment, and I have absolutely no idea what to say.
If not, you're just simply more cutting.
Well, it's a privilege of age. You just don't say anything when you don't have anything to say.
Yeah,
it looks
I think
okay.
Winning a big award,
it
like I think
okay.
if you win a Pulitzer or a Nobel,
oh, yeah.
that you can go to a party and say nothing.
That
and
gives you space.
You're just being quietly brilliant.
It makes a big hole in your.
Well,
it,
I have
it makes
you know,
a majestic hole.
Interestingly
in your,
enough, in preparing myself for both of your intelligences, I actually used.
There is no defense
between the two.
Not between any.
Well, I prepared myself with a Nobel Prize quotation because I figured you never know when you might need it. And Juan Ramon Jimenez, in 1956, won the Nobel Prize. Remember
I'm sorry,
that?
Who?
Juan Ramon Jimenez.
Okay.
You remember him?
That was
no.
very spitty.
I don't remember.
Lovely.
On the scales of your life, give as much to forgetting as to remembering. Watch for their point of equilibrium.
So, again, it's about wisdom. It's
how
knowing
much was it back then?
But again, wisdom, knowing what to overlook.
Right.
Yeah, we come back to the maybe Alzheimer's is a weird kind of blessing.
Oh, it is.
It can be, yeah.
Hell, I mean, I just, you know, I practice forgetting, you know, and so has the world since writing was invented, you know. We have been practicing forgetting. You put everything you know in books, put them in the library, put them in memory sticks so that you can be free to manifest.
And the American language does it beautifully. When you want to speak about something that's irrelevant, you just say that's history.
Sure.
I mean, that's
it's wonderful that it's in the present. That is history.
But that's
history.
But that saddens me somehow.
Doesn't sadden
I mean,
me
can
at
you
all.
Imagine a Frenchman saying "c'est de l'histoire"?
Well, they do actually. They mean they mean that's another story.
Yeah. But let's move on from Vichy, please.
There's another one. It's an answer. In the end, it's all data.
Question. Romania had a rich menu of identities before it.
Well, look, however.
However. It's the cue.